Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all, so welcome in, and in some cases, welcome back. This is the V2V podcast where your voices are heard, your stories are told, and your hearts can begin to heal. I am your host, Dr. Marcy, America's Voice for the Voiceless, and we are in week 3 of Black Business Month. Yay! And so all of our guests this month have been, and I always say are, like there's like 70 people in the room, but all of my guests this month are Black business owners and entrepreneurs. And so I'm always excited to have these conversations and the opportunity to share some of the magnificent and creative ways that Black entrepreneurs are making their mark, both in the for-profit and the nonprofit sectors. We've had a couple of great guests already this month. Tonight is no different. We have a serious subject to talk about tonight, but each week when we get together, you can always expect that there's going to be a healthy adult dialogue and a variety of critical life topics. And so this definitely falls in line with that. You know, it's always my hope that we can provide some food for thought, maybe some inspiration, something that's going to help you turn what you hear and what we discuss into action. That's always my intention every week, is that you're going to hear something that's either going to move you or motivate you or challenge you to make some proactive and sustainable changes in your own life and relationships. And so y'all know I always say that change can't happen around you until it occurs within you. And so this is kind of just the beginning for that in some cases. And before every show each week, I always like to ask that God use this show to have the conversations that you need to hear. And I thank him for the voice, the platform, and the opportunity to become a conduit for healing and recovery. Just as a reminder, we are live here on Blog Talk Radio, and the phone lines are open at 914-219-0880. If you'd like to call in and either listen to the show through the phone, or if you'd like to join the conversation, we definitely would welcome you. And again, that number is 914-219-0880. And tonight's conversation, as I alluded to in the beginning of the intro, is a very, very serious subject matter. It's a very, we're going to have a heart-centered conversation tonight. We actually called this episode Legacy of Love. And I think once we get into the conversation this evening with this amazing woman, you will understand exactly where that came from. So Ms. Angel Harmon is joining me tonight here on the V2V podcast. And to give you a little bit of background about her before she comes on, she was born in 1995 and is living in Baltimore, Maryland. With her Christian faith along with her driven attitude, she works as a family support counselor, plays an active role in her church, and spends her free time developing her charity, Zipporah's Basket. As a woman who had to endure going through miscarriage and stillbirth, Angel has made it her mission to help women who have suffered like her. Zipporah's Basket is a charity whose sole purpose is to give away postpartum care kits to parents who have gone through the tragedy of late-term loss. So, as I said, very serious subject matter, but I definitely think that Angel's testimony tonight is going to kind of inspire somebody to be able to kind of get over some hurdles and then maybe to see how you can turn your pain into purpose as she has. So, Angel, welcome to V2V.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that we were able to make this happen. I think we talked about this many months ago, like 4 or 5 months ago.
Yes.
Because I was so moved when I met you initially at the When Queens Meet retreat with Miss Catherine. So mm-hmm. I'm going to actually stop talking, and I'm going to give you the floor, my darling. And if you could just kind of share your story and share your experience and let me get to know you better and let our listeners become mm-hmm. familiar with you, that would be wonderful. The floor is all yours.
Absolutely, absolutely. So a bit about me. So I grew up in Park Heights. That is a very dangerous neighborhood, drug-infested, crime-ridden neighborhood in Baltimore City, Maryland. And I always had this thought that things would get easier as life got on. And I thought that the younger you are, you're more vulnerable, and the older you get, you're more less destructible, which really doesn't make any sense, but there you go. And playing with that same thought, so as a young child, I went through molestation and had to make it out of my childhood still with that silver lining type of spirit. I was always a positive person. I was always had a very encouraging counseling spirit. And then fast forward, I find a level of freedom that I never have. I got married, and that's okay. Now I'm the captain of my own ship. I'm an adult. I start going to therapy, and within my second year of marriage, I experienced my first loss, a miscarriage. I was 9 weeks, and the baby stopped growing at 7 weeks and 3 days, and I carried that baby until 9 weeks. Fast forward last year, I have my late-term loss. My daughter is the poor Jane Harmon, and it really rocked me, and I didn't know that the older you get, it doesn't make you invincible, but I think if you let age not just be a number, but let it be a level of maturity that you rise to, age brings awareness. And with that self-awareness, you can make a plan. And sometimes that plan is to have no plan and let go. So that's just a little bit of my story.
Wow. So tell me, like, how did you, because I know as a molestation survivor myself, I know that mm-hmm. mentally that experience changed me in a lot of ways that I didn't understand, as you're saying now, like until you get older and you start having some more knowledge and a new level of maturity. I had to go through a lot of things before I really understood some of the things that traced back to that. Do you feel like you have a similar experience after that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. I can really identify that to that. It's a feeling of loss of self because your innocence was taken without permission. And I think with that, at least for me, it kind of developed in a fear of rejection. And I think that manifested in being a people pleaser. So that led me to, okay, the major thing that I focus on in therapy is being assertive, and so I'm still working through that. So it definitely changed me as a person. Like, my thought was that if you, like, are positive, just, like, force yourself to be positive, you are the triangle in the square peg, somehow everything will be okay. But in my experience, I found it erupted. and erupted, and it erupted in such a way in high school where I started to have flashbacks of it. So those suppressed memories, they, you know, really rear their ugly head in high school.
Yeah, you definitely hit the nail on the head about this depression. I also experienced that as well. You said that, you know, that one of the things that you experienced, because it's interesting that you use the word loss with that too, because that's, you know, where we're going to get to in tonight's conversation. But you mentioned the fear of rejection and becoming a people pleaser. I was totally a people pleaser. And I think a lot of it stemmed from that, plus some daddy was daughter issues that I still had. But how were you able to overcome that? Or is that still something, part of it, what you're working through in therapy now?
I think it's definitely something I'm still working on now. I think I'm learning to still give myself the price value of 100, even though I'm still on the assembly line, still under construction.
Oh, I like that. I love how you put that. And there is, you know, there's really something to be said for, you know, knowing your own worth, understanding your value. And I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, we're all always under construction. Like, I don't think you're ever fully together where there's no more room to grow and there's no more room to improve or develop or anything. So, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. You have to give yourself that value of 100 because you're always going to be under construction. You're always under, you know, under new management in some cases. So, where you just really have to kind of regroup and take the reins. So let's talk a little bit about, because, you know, I really wanted to, that was one of the things that was so compelling when I met you, was your ability to share your experience. And so I want you to talk or share, if you feel comfortable, kind of sharing a little bit of how you felt. So you had the first pregnancy loss and the miscarriage at 9 weeks. What kind of feeling was there? And how did you kind of work through that? Because I can only imagine, I've never lost a child. So for me, this is completely new territory. And so I'm totally relying on you to sort of guide this. But what were some of the feelings that went with that?
Sure, that's a great question. The feelings I went through with my early loss, it was disappointment. And I think some people get the idea, oh, you know, you didn't see, you know, a full baby in your hands, rocking it, bouncing it on your knee. So what did you really lose, you know? But there's so many layers of grief when it comes to child loss. Or more specifically, pregnancy loss. But I consider it child loss too, because I'm of the persuasion that as soon as you get a plus on that positive, the pregnancy test, it's a baby. And you not only lose that living being, but you also lose the hopes and dreams, the plans you start making for that child. And a lot of people don't really think about that. And so I would say my feelings were disappointed, and sometimes I felt misunderstood. I felt misunderstood because I felt like a lot of people wanted to give me reassurance or hope for tomorrow by saying, you can try again, you can get pregnant again, that's all that matters, like you weren't even that far along. It was, you know, maybe not people said that exactly, but it was like the attitude behind it. And though it might have been good intentions behind it, it diminished what I truly was feeling, that this was a person. This was my child. This is my child. And as much as I ascribe myself the value of 100%, they deserve that 100% too for the recognition of their life. And I didn't feel like I got that. When I lost that baby, we named the baby Joy. We named her, that's her middle name, Joy. And, yeah. And that was the name I picked out before I lost her. And we just stuck with that. And then my husband gave the first name Hope, so Hope Joy Harmon. And when we got pregnant the second time, we were like, you know what, Hope, birthed hope that we would have Zipporah. That's what we would think about when we were pregnant with her. So it's so interesting how their lives connected. You know, they breathe life into each other. And so I think disappointment is probably the highest emotion I had for that early loss. It was also physical pain because, you know, I had a natural expelling of my fetal tissue. I didn't take any form of abortion pill to help the process go along. I let it happen naturally. I was hoping that by giving the baby more time in the womb, maybe something could change and they would stay. But I had already started bleeding. And after I got an ultrasound, they saw there was no heartbeat. So I never got to hear that baby's heartbeat. And I think it's just, It's a loss of a future as well as a loss of a person. Mm-hmm. And that's why I felt the most disappointed. And, you know, not too many people knew about it when it first happened because I didn't tell, I didn't, like, as soon as I lost the baby, I didn't, like, instantaneously tell everyone. But because it was our first baby, I publicly announced it pretty early on, you know, by the fifth week, you know, and not really knowing any better. I kind of knew there was the old superstition, oh, you're not supposed to say it early because you never know, but I thought that was a superstition and that stuff didn't happen anymore. I really believe that.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm.
No, go ahead. I was just saying, wow, that I've never considered that someone would think that it was, you know, just a myth or not. You know, I mean, we all think certain, like, bad things aren't going to happen to us. Like, bad things happen to other people.
Right.
But I don't think I've ever, like I said, this is new territory for me. And so that's why I was just like, wow, like, that would be really, really traumatic to not even have had that as even a thought, you know what I mean? And then to have it happen.
Right. I was like, is this really happening to me? It felt like very surreal. If you've ever seen, like, the Twilight Zone, it felt like I'm in the Twilight Zone, you know, like, am I bleeding right now? And the crazy thing is, as soon as it happened, I felt that drop from the baby descending, you know, through my birth canal. Like, I knew instantaneously, even though I had never had a baby before, my body just knew, and I immediately said, oh, no, because I knew that was not good.
Right.
And, like, the day before it happened, I was getting, like, little twinges of pain, and I was like, oh, no, it's nothing, and it would be so, I would say, that baby was my obedient child, you know, I would say, oh, it's okay. And then everything would calm down when I would talk to the baby. And so I just resigned myself to peace, peace, peace. But then I also remember when I visited my mother-in-law's house and she introduced me, like, oh, this is my daughter-in-law and she's pregnant. I don't know why. It's almost like my heart knew before my brain knew that I had lost a baby. And I felt like she was lying. I was like, why do I feel like she's lying? And that's it just powerful. Took, yeah.
Well, it just emotionally, like I feel like I'm like there with you in that moment. And there's exactly what you're saying. Like, I just felt it. Like, I felt it was like somehow she was not telling the truth. Like, it wasn't, but you had no, at that point, you had no inkling, no clue that anything was wrong.
Nope. As far as I knew, I was pregnant, and technically I was. I had a baby inside of me. I was pregnant, but the baby wasn't alive, and I didn't know it.
Oh, my gosh. So I want to talk a little bit about two things. One, when you talked about, because I wrote a book called Love Miscarriage, and it was based on the concepts of love being like a child, right? And so you fall in, you get into a relationship, and it's like being pregnant with love. And so you started seeing and envisioning what it's like all grown up, as you do with a pregnancy. And so I want to talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about that process, because I think people discount that process, and I think that's where we can clear up some misunderstanding and misconceptions to kind of help people to help people when they experience a miscarriage during their pregnancy, because I feel like nobody thinks about that. So will you talk about kind of what those plans started looking like talk through some of that so that people kind of get, you really understand the frame of reference for that.
Well, at this point in time, I was in my second year of marriage, and I don't believe I was particularly very close to my family. So this baby was going to bring my family together. So another layer of loss was I felt like I had also disappointed my family, because I felt like somewhat a societal thing, or maybe it's my specific family, I don't know, but I think it is a societal thing, that everyone loves babies. They celebrate life. And it's almost like as soon as you lose baby, it's like everyone runs for the hills. It's like angel who? But and I'm the type of person that laughs, so I don't cry. So this case is someone so uncomfortable. But,
I know, and please, if I ask a question that's too intrusive, be like, Marcy, you're doing too much. Like, seriously, because this is not, I don't want you to feel uncomfortable, and I don't want to trigger anything. And so I have questions, but I want to make sure that you feel safe first. So definitely, if you don't feel comfortable answering, it's too hard.
I feel totally comfortable. I feel like it's very healing for me to share my story, because, like you were saying, my hope is that it will inspire and allow other women to know they are not alone. And I think it's a trick of the enemy that it makes you feel isolated and by yourself, and you feel like people want to hide your loss for you. I think sometimes people's intentions are to protect you by not, like, publicizing, oh, you've had a loss. Some people, will say, get up and wipe those tears and make it happen, And I think that's just people's way of, wanting the old you to come back, because they don't know how to live with the new you. And I think that as awful as it is, it's your responsibility as the person that has personally within your body experienced this loss to be the educator to the people that are around you, your acquaintances, your close family, your extended family, that these are the things that I can handle. These are the things that I can't. And even if it is, you know, saying graciously like, hey, I really, pep talks are no-no right now. No pep talks. Mm-hmm. Life is awful and I just need you to be sad with me. The end. Because sitting in sadness is uncomfortable for people. And
that's what I was going to say. I think that it's not that they want to diminish your experience or rush you to get through it. I think that is the, like you said, like they don't know how, like nobody knows how to support you. And so at that point, nothing that someone says is going to make you feel better. And people who love you want you to feel better. But grief is like literally just a process and you have to go through the stages and the phases and there's not really a shortcut to processing grief and everybody handles it differently.
Right. Absolutely. I agree. My therapist, she talked about this concept at our last support group about her not believing that there's stages of grief. Because it's not a linear journey. It's one of those journeys that you go through step one, you go through step two. Oh, I'm back at one. Oh, I'm all the way at five. Oh, I'm back at one. I remember going to the chiropractor, and I wouldn't have thought I would have seen a baby at the chiropractor. I'm getting my back aligned, getting it shifted into place, and lo and behold, I'm waiting to get on the roller table, and a mom, she emerges from the table, and she's got her little baby carrier, and she's holding her baby in her hands, and it was the weirdest thing. She walked by me, and I just silently cried with, like, one tear going down my face, and I was like, what in the world? I was like, where did that come from? And that was after my loss with my daughter, you know, probably almost a year to it. And that happened. And I'm like, wow, I didn't think that was possible. I thought, you know, there's a definite beginning and there's a definite end, right? And then my therapist was walking me through this concept like, you know, maybe it's your life journey and that's okay. But, you know, it's not the intensity. And maybe the way it's expressed, it'll change based on the different seasons and how intentional you are with making space to grieve. And I think that's so important to literally carve out time. Like, I'm going to cry or I'm going to think of said child and just be sad. Because if you go day after day and you don't say their name, you don't think about them being a person, you don't think about your whole entire pregnancy, the 9 months that you had, and you just try to, you know, do the Men in Black, you know, when they do the little flasher, and then everyone forgets everything, you know. Sometimes you want to disassociate, and you're like, go somewhere else in your mind, but it goes back to that volcano thing, like, the more you stuff it down, it's just preparing to launch, you know?
Yeah, and I think like any kind of emotion, you know, one of the things we talk about in, you know, healing and therapy work and all of that is that you can't heal what you can't speak. And so I think that some people put their healing process on pause because they don't want to feel the emotion. And I'm somebody who hates my emotions, like hates my emotions. And so I've had to learn to make friends with my emotions and to, you know, like you said, give myself permission to just feel whatever it is I'm feeling at any certain point in time. Because you can do yourself a disservice and sort of keep yourself trapped sort of at that level one. Because I think your therapist is exactly right. It's definitely not just, oh, check level one off, check level two off, check level, like, no, it's definitely not.
And that goes with any kind of healing, whether it's grief healing, whether it's trauma healing.
Absolutely. It's
ebbs and flows, and there's, you know, waves and you know, things flash over you and you have triggers and stuff pops up that you're not expecting, or people say something and you're just like, what in the whole world? Like, where did this even come from? But you said something about feeling alone. And so because I didn't have a lot of knowledge about this, I did some research before the show tonight. And it said on average, there are about 1 million pregnancy losses per year and about 24,000 stillbirths. And I think that we hear about the miscarriages probably more than we do the late-term loss and stillbirth, because maybe it's an easier conversation. I don't know. Is there a difference between the two, like how you felt the first time and then how you felt with late-term?
Kind of yes and kind of no. Like, I still felt that same level of disappointment. I think the second time, I completely went into shock. Like, I had a sense of numbness. I had a sense of, like, in my body but not in my body. Because I went through full-on vaginal delivery. So I had to willingly go through labor, and I did have epidural, but when it gets close to pushing, they're like, yeah, we're going to stop the button so you can feel when you know when to push. I'm like, I want to keep clicking this thing. It's painful. So you're willingly going through this painful process of your heart and your body and knowing that all your work is in vain. That's how it feels. You know you're not going home with this baby. You know, you will not be an active parent to this baby, that you are delivering something dead, and that's very morbid. And I think the one thing that really shocked me that I just didn't understand, and I realized it once I realized at the hospital, but then it really hit when I got home from the hospital, is that I did not hear my baby cry. And there was something instinctually inside me that was waiting to hear the baby cry. And it, like, hurt physically not to hear the baby cry.
And so you knew prior to delivery that there was a problem, correct?
That's correct. So I went in for a normal checkup, and she said, how are you feeling? I said, I'm feeling okay. She said, you know, how's the baby's movement? I said, you know, I really don't think I felt her, you know, felt baby move in a while. And she just, like, paused, and I could tell that panicked her. And then she grabbed her little Doppler, and she checked, and she checked, and she checked. And I knew from my first loss, if you're checking that long, it's not a heartbeat. And she said, you know, she let me out the back way. She said she was sorry. I was driving down the hill. My mother-in-law had taken me for that routine checkup. The doctor calls me while I'm driving down the hill and said, no, you have to come back right now. And I was like, right now? I want to go home first. And she said, no, you have to come back right now. I said, well, I want to get my husband. She's like, okay, you can get your husband, but you have to come back right now. He has to go straight to delivery. And that was another shock to my system. Like, whoa, I'm delivering this baby now after I've just gotten huge shock that I've lost this baby. I don't even have time to fully process what's happening. I just have to go, survival mode. And at the time, I didn't know why they were rushing me, but I believe now I know my particular case of stillbirth was undiagnosed and unmonitored gestational diabetes. I went into what's called ketoacidosis, which is having a blood sugar that's over 600, and, you know, it was like almost 600 or a little bit over that, which means I could have gone into a coma and died. So I'm going through, I've lost my child. I have to immediately go to delivery. I don't know what's going on with my body. I felt like this haze over my body the last couple of days. And I thought it was, you know, quote unquote, I'm feeling pregnant, you know. A lot of the symptoms for diabetes is very similar to pregnancy, like you're very thirsty. You know, that's a sign of like your blood pressure is really high, but it's, you know, you're thirsty as well when you're pregnant. So they're very indistinguishable symptoms. And I passed my glucose test, and so there was no red flag that this could be a problem for me. And but there were other factors that left room for further exploration that weren't taken, unfortunately, that could have prevented her death.
And how far along were you?
I was 36 weeks and 4 or 5 days.
Oh, my gosh.
And I delivered her at 37 weeks.
So if they had known, if they'd even caught it like a week before.
Literally. She was okay 1 week 36, before.
37, yeah, 36, 37 weeks is definitely, you know, kids survive that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm just thinking because I can't even imagine the hearing that. And like, so my only frame of reference for it is my second child, my youngest daughter, she was due in February and my water broke in November, right before Thanksgiving. And so they literally put me on bed rest. Like, I could not, like, my oldest daughter's birthday is the beginning of December. Like, the birthday party was literally in the bed. Like, I could not, I wasn't even supposed to get up to go to the bathroom. But I had, like, an ensuite bathroom. So I went ahead, but that was the only time I was allowed to get out of bed. And so that was, I remember the feeling of, I felt like I just had to hold on to this, right? Like I had to drink a gallon of Gatorade a day. I couldn't move around a lot. I had to stay in bed. You know, there were all these stipulations. And like I can remember that feeling of when I stood up and my water broke. And I was like, it's too early. Like I was at work that day. And I said, my water had broke. And I'm like, oh, my God, she's not due for, like, 3 more months. And, you know, panic kind of sits in. And but then when I went to the hospital, like, I never really went into labor. They gave me stuff to keep me from going into labor and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But because she was so close but so far, they felt like it's better to keep her inside the womb than to go ahead and deliver that far preterm and, you know, go through the whole preemie thing or whatever. So they ended up inducing me in January. And they said as soon as she got to be over 5 pounds, then, you know, we could just go ahead and let things. And then if it didn't happen before then they would, you know, we would go ahead and take her once she was, her lungs were developed enough.
Right.
And so that was scary enough. So I can't even imagine hearing, like, you get the news that there's no heartbeat. And so trying to process that, but then now to process, like, I have to immediately turn around and go, like, go do this. How, what was going through your mind?
I think what was going through my mind, I felt unsupported. I felt shocked. The last couple weeks before the loss, past 2 months prior to my loss, I was saying that I was in pain. I was going to see a physical therapist. My baby was part of the 99 percentile, which means if you lined up 10 babies in a line, my baby would have been the biggest. 1 week before, she was 8 pounds and I think 5 ounces. I delivered her at 10 pounds and 2 ounces. So she was fully developed before 40 weeks. So knowing that she was growing faster than her normal gestation age, plus I didn't know this, that I was actually spilling sugar in my urine. And with those two elements together, I really believe there was enough information for the medical team to have acted proactively to either induce me into labor or, you know, whether it be vaginally or C-section. So it's a little bit infuriating, a whole lot infuriating when you think about it. Not everyone's story is this with stillbirth. That my particular one, it was very preventable. Like, she could have been here. And so that makes it that much harder. You know, you want to blame yourself. But in the day, I was without the knowledge that I needed to make the right decision for myself. And then you have hospital policies fighting against what you know is true. You feel something's wrong, and you wonder, why doesn't the doctor induce me? You know, and when I asked those questions, they were like, well, you were too early at the time. You know, you were 35, you were 36. You know, we don't do inducing unless we know it's an emergency. And you had
a non-time baby at that point. Like she was more than big enough to be okay.
Right, exactly. So, you know, they said their excuses, but I don't agree at all with it. And I think as a Black businesswoman, my platform, I want to give a voice to Black women in pregnancy, to women that have not experienced a loss, so they won't become in the number, so they won't become the 1 in 4, so they won't become the 1 in 160 births to become a stillbirth. I don't want them to be in this group. I've heard it said in many support groups for pregnancy loss, nobody wants to be a part of this group, but we are a very welcoming community where we really do link arms and we support each other, which I'm grateful for. But I really want to prevent this. My particular doctor said, we didn't know this could happen. And I know that's not true for many reasons. I'm not going to go into that bit because that's another discussion. But what I will say is we have to make sure we're educating women about their body and to trust their instincts and to know just because a doctor has a degree, they're not always right. And do not be afraid to ask for what you need. Do not be afraid to be perceived as, oh, the worry wart. I have, you know, diagnosed anxiety. I have, you know, PTSD. I have depression. And my doctor knew that I had anxiety, and they knew I had a previous loss. So when I brought up questions or concerns or expressed I'm in pain, it was very dismissive, very dismissive. And a lot that I read up on, that a lot of times, you know, Caucasian doctors, you know, they might have a social bias that, oh, you know, black women are strong, they can take it, or I'm a first-time mom. Maybe to some people's eyes, I had never made it that far in pregnancy before. So everything's new to her. They've delivered 1,000 babies. They're like, oh, look at that new mom. She's complaining. This is what happens to every mom. And not saying I need to treat her as high risk until proven otherwise. I think that's the way the medical arena, they need to change their mindset to treat every woman as if they're high risk, to use the level of being meticulous and saying, you got to prove that you're not high risk. We're going to treat you and watch you under microscope, because I was undiagnosed. And because it was undiagnosed, it was unmonitored, and that's what led to her death. But had someone been looking closer, they would have saw it was a lot of evidence to prove that something was going wrong. I was literally dying in front of people, and I didn't know it.
But even her gestational size should have been some sort of a red flag, because that happens. I mean, that didn't jar anything, like that she was growing still. I mean, because she's growing really, really rapidly.
She was, in her anatomy scan, she was measuring 2 days ahead, and they said, oh, well, we're not going to change your due date. You know, it's just 2 days ahead. And that was all that they said about that. And then after I lost her, you know, the doctor was like, yeah, something about the 99% percentile. They're just throwing, you know, doctor jargon at me. They're not speaking in layman's terms. I'm in shock. And I'm like, what? And they said things to imply that it was my fault, which I also felt like that right there, that made me want to go 5 to 10.
Right.
The anger scale.
Right. Well, and I think, too, as black women, just in general, I think, you know, there was a study done on black girls, like young girls. And so that black girls were perceived to be of higher ages than what they were. So in other words, if a black female child is like 9 years old, she was perceived by others to be closer to 13 or 14. And the same thing with black males. So the expectation then becomes that they're supposed to behave in a way that is over and above. So if a black child is acting like their age, right, 8 or 9, and they're doing 8 or 9 year old things, mm-hmm. They may be disciplined differently because the expectation is that they should be acting, or they should know certain things, or they should be behaving in a certain way. But those behaviors and that information, that wisdom, that level of knowledge comes mm-hmm. at a later age. And so I think that translates into how black men and black women are treated in a variety of different ways. And I definitely mm-hmm. think that there's some things in the healthcare field where you have to advocate a little bit harder, and you have it's almost like you have to get your own like mini medical degree, and like you're researching mm-hmm. your own drugs, and you're researching your own, like you have to do all of that. And I feel like it's abnormally common for minority patients to experience that.
It's really unfortunate, and I agree. And that's definitely one of the purposes and reasons why this organization started. I felt very slighted in some circumstances, specifically about the recovery aspect. I delivered my daughter. They gave me a few supplies, postpartum care supplies, and then I felt like I needed more. So they said, ask for more if I need it. And I asked for more, and she's like, well, I gotta go to delivery or whatever. And she kind of scurried off, almost like, man, I got to go all across the hospital to the other wing to get what you need, you know. And it was just like, I have literally, like, lost one of the most magnificent things that's ever come into my life, And you are complaining because you have to go across the hall to get me what I need. And I got home and I realized I was actually missing one of the items, a sitz bath, for the healing process. And thankfully I had a good doula, and she came during her off hours to bring me the sitz bath and even more, you know, postpartum recovery things like large pads and adult diapers. Because you have to go through all the nitty-gritty, unpleasant, unbeautiful recovery on top of feeling emotionally like trash. So that is where the heart is behind the Poor's Basket, where we focus on caring for the body, and then by extension, we hope to care, you know, for their heart to help lead them in that process of recovering emotionally. Because I told myself, you were saying, like, what were you thinking about in the hospital? Like, what I was thinking of, I literally said, just get through this. I literally thought, just keep going. I thought to myself, like, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And I was thinking, okay, I'll go back to school. That's what I'll do. You know, I was thinking of all these plans to redirect the focus. So it wasn't like, oh, Angel is a failure. Angel lost. Angel, because I was very public with my pregnancy. And I was like, oh, this is our rainbow baby from our miscarriage, da-da-da-da. We had a photo shoot. It was, like, very publicized. So to go from that to, oh, yeah, it didn't work out the way I thought, it was embarrassing. And I'm not sure if a lot of people think about that aspect, that you kind of feel like a social pariah. I have one friend. She's like, where's Waldo? I haven't seen her since my loss. And I'm like, that's really unfortunate, but you really, really, it really weeds people out that are really your friends, and then people that are just acquaintances or that were seasonal, you know, acquaintances. And it's unfortunate, but it's a life lesson. But that's definitely in the heart behind, you know, the Poor's Basket. And something else that greatly inspired the organization was the funeral home, a nonprofit called Gone Too Soon that did my daughter's arrangements. They came and picked up my daughter from the hospital, and they had people that rock all the babies that come to them, and they pray over them, and they have made like crocheted and knitted handmade blankets for them, and they just love on them and give them so much dignity, so much love, so much respect for the people that they were in those bodies. And I was so enamored, if that's the right word. I admired so much the way that they loved and cared on those children. My daughter, they saw her as a person, and that's something I didn't feel like I got the first time I had my loss. But this time, everyone can see this baby. So I felt more support, like, publicly, because people didn't feel as awkward because they physically saw a person, and they were like, oh, that's a loss. That's a real loss because I see it, you know? And I was inspired by Gone Too Soon. And I was like, the way that they love those children, that's the way I want to love the moms and dads that have gone through this.
That is so beautiful. So when did you come up with the idea of starting the Poor's Basket?
So it might have been maybe a month or two after I lost her. And me and my husband, you know, we were feeling really empty and lost. And we were like, you know, how are we going to fill that void? We're parents, but we don't have any children. And that's a really awkward place to be. And they, Gone Too Soon, they pick up the babies in a Moses basket. And my daughter's name was Zipporah, and that is Moses' wife's name in the Bible. And first I was thinking, oh, Zipporah's bundle or I don't know, bin or something. I don't know. Or Zipporah's box, I was thinking at first. And then my husband said, what about Zipporah's basket? Because they carried her in a Moses basket. And I was like, that's genius. I love that. And mm-hmm. we knew that we wanted, I said, you know, everyone's going to be getting a little piece of Zipporah. Zipporah's going to get to love and care on other people through this. And it's a way that I can keep her memory alive. I can mother her from afar. It's a quote, an unknown quote that says, living parents, you know, they parent their child. And then basically survivor parents, parents of lost children, we parent and we protect their memory. That's what we do.
Mm. Wow. I'm just listening to, you know, just listening to your story and, you know, trying to emotionally comprehend how hard it has to be to go through all of that process, have all of those emotions and feelings, and then dealing with the medical system and, you know, being fed information that you can't trust, and then still being able to find and say, you know what, how can I turn this into something that honors my daughter?
Mm-hmm.
Like, was there, I'm just trying to understand, like, it just seems so mm-hmm. amazing to me. Because I can't think of anything that would be harder than losing your job. Like, I just can't. And this is still relatively fresh for you because you said it was about a year or so ago?
Yep, it's been a little bit over a year. She was born on June the 10th of last year.
And for you to be able to, you know, have this level of transparency and vulnerability and honesty about your experience, you know, I applaud your courage and I applaud your strength because a year's not a lot of time to get past it. So have you found that having Zipporah's basket has kind of helped you in that process a little bit?
Absolutely, 100%. Just having an excuse to say her name, quite honestly, and it be publicly acceptable. That alone feeds my soul, where I get to share about the person that she was, very energetic, moves a lot, and very bossy and stubborn. I felt all that in the wound. I was like, wow, she's really going to give me a run for my money, but I'm like, okay, where did she get that from, though? Okay, that's me. you know, and it's just like no one will get to know the person I saw like every waking moment, waking me up at 5 a.m. to go to the bathroom. And I say bossy because when I would lay on my right side, which is not the best side to lay on, but, you know, you start getting numb when you lay only on your left side.
Mm-hmm.
She would give me a hard kick to be like, yeah, Mom, you need to turn over. This is the other side's better. So she definitely let her know her needs be made known. And I was like, definitely a character trait. And I just felt like she was going to have the best combinations of both me and my husband. Like, my husband is the outgoing person. I'm like the sassy person that has too much of an opinion that sometimes it gets me in trouble. But I hope that it felt like she would have the extrovert to pull it off, where I'm a little bit more quiet about it. So I was like, wow, she's going to be amazing.
Well, and I think by you starting the nonprofit in her name, and, you know, giving it her name, I think she's still doing some of that, you know, and
yeah.
she's still contributing, and she's still giving, and she's still gifting, and but just in a different way than, you know, you could have ever wanted to imagine, you know.
Right. And it really makes me smile that, and my hope, honestly, is to bring awareness of gestational diabetes as well, because as I mentioned previously in my story, you know, the doctors were saying, oh, we didn't know this could happen, even though gestational diabetes is one of those top risks that increase your risk factor by 44%, that your pregnancy will end in a stillbirth. So these are, when you were talking about how women of the Black community, we have to be educated about our bodies. This is the message I want to get out to them, that, you know, get a device that pricks your fingers to check your sugar while you're going through your pregnancy. Don't rely on your doctor solely to get all the answers for your body. Be responsible as you can be. Like, I really don't understand why when you go for a checkup, they check your height, your weight, and your blood pressure, but they don't check your blood sugar. That's kind of mind-baffling to me. But And maybe that's a fight for another day, but right now I'm just going to focus on helping moms and dads right where they are, and any other battles, we'll save that for tomorrow, another day.
So tell us what all you're doing through the organization, and how you're helping parents.
So presently we are doing monthly support groups. They're virtual, and about every quarter to 3 months we have an in-person event. And we come together. The last one we had was a few days after Zipporah's birthday. I think we had it on the 11th, one day after her birthday. And we had just a handful of women come and share a bit of their story. We create a safe place for moms and dads to express their love for their children, their yearning for their children, and just a safe place to say, I'm not okay, and it's okay to not be okay. And to fill them up with hope that even though you may not see a tomorrow being worse at times, because I know when I first came home from the hospital, I definitely struggled with suicidal thoughts. I really did not see, like, the purpose of going on. I was just like, if I can't do this and I'm a woman, like, how much of a woman am I really, you know? But I had to really go back to the foundation of my identity. Is my identity in what I do and what I produce, or is it in what I'm grounded in? And what I'm grounded in is who made me, and as a believer of Jesus Christ, I believe it's God. And my worth doesn't come from what I do. It comes from what God has already done for me. He made me fearfully and wonderfully. I'm a masterpiece. And everything else is just embroiderment in my life. It doesn't subtract from me. It only makes what's already perfect through Christ, only through Christ. It only makes it shine more. And losing my daughter, it definitely took me through, I guess, what people call the trendy word, deconstructing their faith and then rebuilding it back up. And I'm the type of person, I've seen God move in some undeniable ways. So it was like, well, I can't deny he's real. Well, I'm going to just be mad at him. That's it. I'm going to be mad. And pout and be like, well, I'm going to my room and I don't want to talk about it. That's literally how I was with God. And God was so patient and loving with me to say, whenever you're ready, come back. I'm here. I'm not far from you. The word says that he is near to the brokenhearted. And I was broken and still am brokenhearted. About it, I think that God has given me the grace, and that grace is more than enough sufficient. It's sufficient for everyday living so I can make it. And he's given me a lot of hope for the future. And this business, this charity has been a huge catalyst for that, that I can bring change in this world to prevent this nightmare from happening to other families. And another resource that we offer is our YouTube channel. My husband, he found that it's really hard to get a bunch of guys in a room and talk about their feelings. Shocker.
Yeah.
So he does the YouTube channel, and we're working on making it a monthly thing where he will share the dad's perspective of loss. We have part one of that video up on our YouTube channel. And I really encourage family members to watch it and all the good things. And I definitely recommend this book as well. It's by Candy McVicker and also Gary Chapman, which is the same man who wrote the book, The Five Love Languages. It's a really great book they wrote together. I believe it's called What to Do When You've Lost a Baby. And it talks to the perspective of a mother that's lost her child. It has specific chapters for grandparents. It has specific chapters for the parents themselves. It has, you know, what to say, what not to say for friends and family. And I find that so important. And that's a component that we hope to help to educate family members of these parents of lost little ones, of how you can really come around them and support them and sit in the uncomfortable, sit in the unpleasant, and be a companion. I think of Job when he lost his children, and like all the things, is a very popular biblical story where he's lost his children, and all the things he pretty much has left is a nagging wife. And he refuses to curse God and die. And he had some friends that came, and they just sat with him. Now, a little bit later, they kind of weren't the best friends. But let's focus on when they were good friends. and when they were good friends, they were just sitting. Their mouths were shut, and they were sitting beside him. And honestly, that is how you mourn with other people. You sit with them. You sit in the uncomfortability. You're committed to empathy. Empathy is, I've heard it expressed as getting down in the pit, in the hole with the person and sitting there with them. And sympathy is you're looking down in the well, down in the ditch and saying, man, that looks rough. But you won't get in there with them. And it's not for the faint of heart with empathy. And I think the most easiest way to get in the pit to sit and express empathy is to donate, to acknowledge that this is a serious issue that needs hands to the plow, all hands on deck. We need to get these resources to mothers. We need to make them feel heard, understood, seen, their voices heard, their bodies healed, their hearts mended. We need that. And it starts with everybody listening, chipping in, and being a part of the process, this beautiful journey of caring for women's bodies and then by extension caring for their heart.
And so you mentioned, you know, you mentioned your husband a few times and his role that he's playing in, you know, even coming up with the name for the organization and, you know, doing videos and giving men sort of a voice. How have you guys found that as a couple? Because, you know, a stress like this is sometimes a straw that breaks the camel's back. Like even the strongest relationships struggle. Mm-hmm. When you go through something like this, because everybody's grieving in their own way. So what are some things that you guys have found that helped you guys to kind of be successful as a couple through this and be able to focus on the nonprofit together and come together on that?
That's a great question, and you are definitely right. There was definitely some times where we butted heads and we isolated ourselves because men and women, it's a thing, it's a factual thing, they grieve differently. And I would say the way that we've stayed together as a married couple and how we continue our partnership in this charity is we have what we call table talks, where we just sit at the dining room table and we say, how are you feeling? How are you really feeling emotionally? Like, don't give me that answer you give people when they say, how are you doing? I'm fine. I'm good. How are you really feeling? How are you coping today with our daughter not being here with us? And we get to be a safe place for each other and encourage each other to break down if we need to, be strong for the other one if we have that capacity, and give each other grace when we don't have that capacity. And sometimes it's just be two wrecks together, and it's just like, I don't have the capacity, me either. and just huddle in a ball and just be like, oh, life is so rough. And it's just reminding yourself that this is your best friend, you know. I can only speak to my own marriage. My husband is my best friend. And if my other best friend, Lachey, is listening, yeah, she's my best friend too. But but my romantic best friend is my husband. and, you know, he is quite the very, like, chipper person. He's like, Angel, this is a silver lining, and do-do-do-do for, like, all other things. But when this happened, I saw this really break him. And that's saying something, because my husband, he is so happy and so cheerful sometimes. I want to shake him sometimes.
Right. Those annoyingly happy people.
Yes. But you know what? God knew what to do, because he knew that I deal with depression and I need mm-hmm. somebody to be like, isn't the sun shining? I'm like, oh, I hate the sun. But, you know, he helps me to really see all the bright spot in life. And when this really, really got to him, and I mean, it got to me too, but I was like, it must be really bad if he said, you know. And it just honestly gave me comfort to just be human. That's something I tell my husband, like, I need to know that you're not okay, because it makes me feel better. It makes me feel like I'm yeah. not unusual for still, that I'm not behind in my grieving process. Oh, I didn't see you cry. And you know, men, sometimes they like to go alone, be by themselves and, mm-hmm. you know, express their emotions and whatnot. And we had to have a talk about that and say, I'm not trying to run from you. I'm trying to be strong for you. And we, as wives, we have to be a soft place for them to land and encourage yeah. them. And to me, those emotions are strength, because you are being a leader to me in how to be vulnerable and strong and courageous by just being truthful.
Well, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, being human. And I think mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, boys are raised to, you know, big boys don't cry, and, you know, real men mm-hmm. don't cry. And, you know, there's all these, you know, all this misinformation and, you know, stuff that we pour into children. You know, mm-hmm. girls are supposed to be this and boys are supposed to be that, and girls aren't supposed to do this and boys aren't supposed to do that. And I think as we mm-hmm. shift, you know, some of the gender identity stuff and some things that are happening in the world today, I think some of that you're seeing shift a little bit. But at the end of the day, remembering that we all bleed and we all do have emotions. And, you right. know, I applaud him and I celebrate him for being able to, like you said, have the courage to be vulnerable with you. Because a lot of guys, even if you tell them, like, I, you know, this is what I need, they literally just don't have it to give. Like, they, yeah. it's been trained out of them how to be emotional and to, you know, attach with vulnerability. And so I celebrate him and I applaud him and you too for, you know, like you said, being that safe place to land. And, you know, I think from what you're describing, I think it's that combination that you guys have found that's like, you know what, like you said, like if we just need to just be a wreck together, then that's okay too. Like, I think you've both given mm-hmm. each other permission to be human and to have your own, although you both have a shared experience with the loss of your daughter, you both still have independent journeys how you have to navigate the world without her.
Absolutely. I like how you touched on that, individual journeys, because I think that's also another aspect that people may not consider with men and women grieving differently. And, I mean, just people in general, like different family members who, whether, you know, they're close, their proximity to the baby and around us in our lives, their perspective may be different based on how well they, you know, got to see me pregnant with her and things like that. And mm-hmm. we just have to give people grace for where they are, you know, and their level of coping. And a lot of times you have to be the bigger person because people say stupid stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think in some instances with stuff like this, like, they're not, you know, nobody's trying to say it with malice, but you just don't yeah. know the right thing to say. You don't know the right terms to use. You don't know, mm-hmm. You know, what's the hot button. Like, and you definitely don't want to be that person that causes a breakdown because, gosh, then I got to deal with that, and I'm not prepared to deal with that, you know. So I think people do kind of maybe steer away from trying to have that conversation. So I love what you said earlier, like, just sit. Like, you don't have to say anything. And people get really mm-hmm. uncomfortable in silence. And it's like, silence doesn't have yeah. to be awkward. Silence can be so therapeutic. Like, just sit there and don't say anything. How about that?
Yep. Yeah. And that's my greatest hope and prayer, that I encourage and empower, you know, society at large to just sit in the uncomfortable, and it's okay to be still. I feel like that's one of the words God gave me for this year, be still and rest. And the whole idea about not chasing happiness, but resting and trusting in God to find contentment, which means you're no longer looking to have more, have the best, to esteem yourself of value. 'Cause that type of thinking, I think, definitely pulled me deeper into my depression after I lost my daughters, because I saw my daughter as an accomplishment, and I still do. I still do. She is one of the greatest things I've made. I'm biased. I'm her mother. I think she was beautiful.
And, I saw her on the website. Is that her on the website?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. She's absolutely gorgeous. You know, you're right about that.
Thank you. And, yeah, and I'm proud of her, but just as any parent with a living child has to let that child have autonomy apart from them, like, my daughter is not my identity. And I think releasing that gives me freedom to, you know, have hope. You know, as a Christian, it's like, I will see her again, and I can spread the joy that she gave to me and to so many people. I remember at the baby shower, there are people that I didn't even know giving us baby presents. And even at the funeral, there are people that were sending cards and, you know, tokens of condolences. And I did not know those people. That she was so loved by so many people in life and in death. And I was like, she was an amazing person. And God was speaking to my heart, and I was like, she was so young. She didn't get to live her purpose. And then God was like, who says you have to live a long life, a long time to live your purpose? Did you ever think maybe she did?
Right.
And I feel like a part of her purpose fulfilled was being a catalyst of drawing me closer to him, to knowing he's sufficient, he's enough for everyday living. You know, God is sovereign. I don't pretend to have all the answers. I'm just going to point you to Jesus because I know he has all the answers. And I'm just going to tell people from the mountaintop, that is where I'm finding my rest. That is where I'm finding my peace. That is where I'm finding my joy in this new season of my life. You know, I have, like, the freedom to experience other things because I'm not an active parent. That's what I like to call it, because all the ones that are listening tonight, I just want to validate you and say you are a parent. Even if you've lost your child, you are a parent. And wear that badge proudly. You're a parent. You know, a side of the coin that is unpublicized and unpopular and very unpretty, but you are a parent.
Yeah, and I think that can make some people uncomfortable when you say that, because then they have to really start thinking about their perception and their perspective. Because I think that you're absolutely right. Now, if she had taken a breath for a day, then they would view it one way. But the fact that she didn't, then they viewed it like, but no, she was here. She was real. She was, you know, and it was your daughter. And, you know, I think that that's the part where I think that I really wanted to have this conversation to help people to understand that, because, you know, part of healing is learning how to help people when they need to be supported. And I think sometimes we don't support because we don't know how, and we don't want to say the right thing, and we don't want to say the wrong thing. So we say nothing at all, or we just disappear, like, oh, well, I'll get back to them in 6 months when they're over it. But there's something you're never going to come over, you know? And certainly I think this would definitely fall into that category. It's not something that you get over to a human being. So we have about 3 minutes left. So tell everybody, where is the website? What do they need to do? How they can find you? And I will also post the links in the group and on my page as well. But for the listeners, they can make notes.
Sure, absolutely. So they can best reach me at our email, which is basketofzipporah@gmail.com. Our website is www.basketofzipporah.org. And you'll see a Give Now link in the top right corner of our website. And, you know, we really appreciate your contributions to our mission to care for the body and hearts of moms and dads that have experienced this late-term loss of stillbirth, and we want to work towards putting together these postpartum care kits and getting them to the moms, because unfortunately stillbirths are a reality, and they have been more than we would like to admit, and we need your help. And Support Basket, that's our YouTube channel, and you know, if you want to chat with me via email, I'm always open for that. We have a Facebook page as well. You can at Basket of Zipporah and tag us. And thank you for all the listeners. And thank you, Marcy.
Oh, absolutely. You're welcome. And so, you guys, Zipporah is spelled Z as in Zulu, I-P-P as in Paw-Paw, O-R-A-H. So it's Basket of Zipporah. .org. So that's the website. Angel, thank you so much. I know this wasn't an easy conversation, so I applaud you for being willing to have it with me. I think that you shared a lot of good information and gave us all a lot of things to think about. So I appreciate you. Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right, guys, and so thank you for tuning in tonight. That is our show for tonight. Again, thank you, Ms. Angel Harmon. Make sure you guys go check out her website at basketofzipporah.org. And as a reminder, if you have a story of your own that you'd like to share, some knowledge that you want to drop, there's a form on my website that you can fill out. Just go to marcybatiste.com/V, the number 2, the letter V, and you can complete the form. You'll also find a link there to all of our past episodes, and then the replay for tonight's episode with Miss Angel will be there as well. And every week I say that survival is a responsibility, but so is success. And so sustainable life change is well within your reach. And if you have questions about how to go about making some proactive changes, if you've experienced, you know, the loss of a child, late-term loss, miscarriage, whatever, and you need some support, check out basketofzipporah.org and reach out to Miss Angel through her organization. And in the meantime and in between time, guys, this is Dr. Marcy, America's Voice for the Voiceless, signing off, and Ms. Angel and I wish you health, safety, and success until we link up again next week here on the V2V podcast. Good night, everybody. Thank you, Angel.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
All right. And that is our show for tonight, guys. And we will see y'all next week.